Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're glad you're with us on this Thursday afternoon, and we can talk with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes today from his office in Frankfort, and we'd love to have your questions as part of that discussion. You can always call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can send emails for Mayor McBarnes to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon to you. Thanks as always for being with us.
Stan, my pleasure.
So I wanted to mention that I imagine you are talking to us from your newly renovated office in Old Stoney. Is that correct?
We are back home. We are back home in Old Stoney, and boy, does it feel good. It was great that the utilities offered us up some space at our local IT data center. The price was right, and it worked very well for customer service and our public meetings. But to say the least, it's great to be back in Old Stoney. No one likes to move, especially when you have to move out of a building that's over 100 years old and then come back in. You can imagine all the things and the clutter and the stuff that you didn't think you had that you really had. But it's given us the opportunity to not only renew the building, but just get it nice and clean, and to have things here that are appropriate for city services. And yes, I still have a few boxes laying around my office, and today's really the first day I could get proper work attire on. I've been in jeans and a t-shirt to help our city employees move over boxes and furniture, but it was really a team effort this week, Stan. We had great help from our street employees, our building services employees. My assistant Tina Stock's been wonderful in helping clean up the office, and we're finally getting settled. So all city services that people once enjoyed are now back in Old Stoney, and we're open for business.
I wonder if you think the former state of the building prior to the renovations was keeping people at all from coming in to access the services that were in the building, or coming in to maybe even talk to you about how they feel the city is doing. And are you hoping to encourage more of that now that it's a more welcoming place for people to come?
Absolutely, especially after we get the landscaping done in the spring of next year. At this point in time, it's a little late in the year to get our landscaping done. Our fountain, the Magnus Johnson Fountain, a historic fountain that was intended by the sculptor to be here at Old Stoney, is also being brought back to life here on the South Lawn. So it's going to be a very much more welcoming atmosphere, and the outside of the building looks so much fresher, looks cleaner, and even though it's a historic building, it really has that new flair to it. I want to caution people, though, you know, when they come inside the building, it was never our intent to create a completely 21st century looking city hall. We wanted to be very respectful to the historic integrity of this building, especially being on the National Historic Register. 90% of the project is what you can't see, what's behind the walls, the roof. But it's important for people to know that this building now has very strong bones and can withstand the test of time. Some things, though, Stan, that we implemented in this project were many ADA accessibility requirements that were upon the city with the ADA law being passed on the national level, and rightfully so. So people, when they visit our restrooms, those have been modernized. They've been made a little bit bigger. Our elevator is now modern. We have technology in our city council chamber halls for individuals that may have a hearing aid, so they can hear the meeting. So there are several things that people will come to enjoy, especially those that maybe felt as though that we didn't have a building that could support their needs in the past.
Moving on to other things, you and I talked a couple of months ago, and I had meant to get on our conversation last month, but we didn't have time to do an update on the debate over wind energy and how it's proceeding there. And I noted that there was another wrinkle just before our last show where the county commissioners had decided not to hire a consultant. Instead, they wanted to just sort of lift that person's testimony, interestingly, from other cases that he had been involved with, and kind of assume that those would reflect his recommendations for Clinton County. Do you think that's a sensible way to proceed?
Well, it was a chunk of money, and you know what I think we're seeing here as well, Stan. Keep in mind, we're going to see a transition with our commissioners. We have two incumbent commissioners that did not prevail in their election cycles this year, so 66% of our commissioners are going to be brand new starting January 1, and it's really going to be up to those individuals. Now these new individuals are going to carry the majority of where wind energy goes in our county. Ultimately, the area plan board, they can make recommendations to change ordinances, but eventually this is all going to come down to those three county commissioners, and especially the two new incoming county commissioners have not really heard them make a lot of significant public statement. Basically, all I've heard them say is, you know, we'll be open to listening, we'll be open to the conversation, and we'll make a decision that's best for Clinton County. That's pretty much what I know has been said at this point in time. In regards to this particular consultant, I believe the reasoning was is that he's made significant testimony in certain court cases across the country, and that testimony could really just be percolated and taken out of those statements and applied here in Clinton County. Whether that was the right decision or not, I don't know. I don't know if I'm in a position to say that. I do know, though, that the area plan has made the recommendation that setbacks, if any wind energy does happen in Clinton County, it has to be, I think, over 1,500 feet, I believe, away from the nearest home, and then that sound level cannot exceed 45 decibels. So all of those recommendations will go to those county commissioners, and they will be charged with having a good, spirited discussion, and if we have development, they will be the ones to say yes or to say no.
This has been a debate that's gotten the public interested over the last several months. What is your sense? Do you think that the wind debate played any role in the two incumbent commissioners being voted out?
No, I definitely think it probably had to do something with it. I mean, wind energy has been a very divisive topic in Clinton County. People are very emotional and they're very passionate on both sides of the aisle. And you know, I told you this some months ago, and I'm going to say it again today. I would like to see an economic debate around these windmills. What is it going to mean for the AV of Clinton County? How does that correlate into the reduction of taxes coming out of the average person living here, their pocket? What kind of actual sustainability would it provide to the school district that's in the eastern part of our county? And with a new leader coming in on the national level, and you know, now we can say definitively the Republicans do control the House, they control the Senate, and of course the White House. How is that going to change future federal subsidies to wind energy and that development? And is that business without those subsidies, is it sustainable? And is it viable? Those are all questions I think that need to be talked about. And of course, then the aesthetics, how they look, how they feel, the sound, the health impacts, how it affects the environment, obviously that plays into it as well. But something interesting now, the Clinton Central Schools had a referendum on the ballot, which I believe passed this election cycle. So now that that has been passed, that might change people's minds. People in the eastern part of the county might not think that wind energy is such a necessity now that they voted to carry that school district and that bottom line through paying more taxes on an annual basis.
Why do you think there's a correlation between those two?
Explain your question a little bit.
Why do you think there's a correlation between voting for an education referendum and deciding whether they want additional wind energy distributed in and created by the eastern part of the county?
Well, the reality is in running a community and supporting any organization that depends on tax revenue, you have to grow your assessed value. You have to grow your assessed value so you keep everyone's tax rate at a reasonable level and you have a bigger revenue stream. And it's been very public that the Clinton Central Schools have been struggling simply because the eastern part of our county is largely made up of agriculture, not blessed with the industrial corridor that we have in other areas of the city. So the bottom line has been a big discussion, and that school corporation's survival has been on the line. And one faction of that was, one part of the conversation was, if we did have wind energy in that part of the county and it significantly grew the AV and significantly more revenues would go to that school, it would help that process. What I'm saying is now that referendum has been carried, the people there might be saying, hey, you know, we're willing to pay more taxes to keep our school going. We're proud of our school. We're proud of where our kids go. And so that dire need to bring an incredible amount of AV, which if you're going to do it in that part of the county, wind may be the way to do it, might not be as important today as it was a month ago.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Although I would say that I believe there is a part of state statute that says if you pass a school funding referendum, which to give the listeners a sense is basically allowing the school corporation to go above and beyond the state's property tax caps by a little bit. Mm-hmm. I believe there is a statutory limit of about 7 or 8 years on those things. I don't think you can take one referendum and go longer than that, whereas you would expect the wind turbines to be there for considerably longer than that if you were to install them. So are you saying that this – I mean, it seems to me that this is a discussion of short-term funding versus long-term infrastructure and long-term improvements to the assessed valuation. Would you assess it that way?
Yeah, and Stan, I'm not familiar with the state statute in terms of school referendum. So I trust you in what you're saying there. And if it is only 7 to 8 years, then, you know, maybe this is just a Band-Aid in the interim. And at the end of the day, we still need to look at increasing the AV of our community in that specific geographic section of the community in order to keep that school corporation viable. There's a lot to be discussed, but again, you know, I'm going to pull back to the economics of wind energy, especially with new federal leadership, with potentially a new direction of, you know, going back to fossil fuels, becoming energy independent, more drilling, more of a concentration on going back to coal, potentially cleaner coal. You know, is it viable without government subsidies? If our community is going to take this giant leap, if, and that's a big if, and this goes back to those three commissioners, and two out of the three commissioners are brand new, and I know we'll find out their views come January after a discussion with the community, is wind right? Because this is something we're going to have to live with. And if those windmills were to be decommissioned in the future, what does that process look like? So the area plan, they've been pulling their weight, they've been doing a lot, but eventually it's going to come down to those three executives and the direction that they take Clinton County. And of course, we'll be at the table. We want to be a part of those discussions because obviously what happens in any part of this community does affect Frankfort. We're the county seat.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. Please call in your questions for him. 765-496-1999 is our telephone number. You can send emails to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, speaking of improvements to the community, the city is trying to get ready for the improvements to State Road 28 that NDOT is planning for 2019. And I was interested in the kind of tone of those discussions. You and some of the other elected officials seem to be saying that you want your requests to be as specific of NDOT as possible so that as little is left to chance as possible. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a state thoroughfare that cuts our road north and south coming through the community, and if it's done right, I think it can be a big asset to the community. If we don't have a voice in the process, NDOT's not going to know, and it's really, I don't see it as being their job to come to us. It's our community. If we want to see something bigger and a little more extravagant with a few more amenities in mind, it's our job to go to them. And our city council and myself, we pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps and we're doing that because we know that once this road gets rebuilt, it's probably not going to be touched again for 30 or 40 years. So we want to advocate for the things that we believe are important based on what we're hearing from our constituency. And a few of those things is drainage. We have some terrible drainage issues, especially in the Western Corridor that businesses and homes are suffering with when we get big rain. So we want to talk to NDOT about that. We want to talk to them about a walking friendly Western Corridor, something that keeps the pedestrian in mind, because I believe this section of roadway, Stan, if we can build it with some multi-purpose paths and a trail, that then in the future this can be a beachhead for trails. So in the future, mayors and councils and county commissioners can kind of band off of this key thoroughfare through the middle of Frankfort and build north and south in Clinton County. And then also just the gateway experience, having the antique-style street lighting, have adequate lighting in general, having some planted medians, creating a gateway that welcomes people through our industrial corridor into our historic downtown is very important to us. And then we have a very complicated, what we refer to as locally, the jog at Hoke and Walnut. And I'm sure people from Frankfort, if they're listening to me right now, they're probably rolling their eyes because this is a very, very complicated intersection that when you get behind people, especially that are from out of town, it gets dangerous. And so we've went to NDOT and we've said, listen, yes, I guess it's functional, like it's barely functional. We want to make it smooth. We want to make it something that's actually safe, that people are going to be able to understand, that's going to be conducive not only to small vehicles but semi-truck traffic. So we're working with them on that as well. So we've taken to them our specific requests. They're going through technical reviews, and then we'll be meeting with them the first week of December, actually, to go through more of this and to understand if it will be 100% on the city to fund these, if you want to call them upgrades, or whether NDOT's prepared to partner with us in some type of a cost-sharing agreement. So that's where we're at right now. State Road 39 was rebuilt in our community a number of years ago, Stan, and you know, I'll point to the specific northern section of Jackson Street or State Road 39. So many trees were taken out and then they were never replanted, and it's this big, stark, barren roadway, and it's just a crying shame. We don't want that to happen with State Road 28, so we're trying to go through this process to prevent that.
What leverage, if any, do you have to try to prevent that from happening again?
Well, I think, you know, in all of our conversations with NDOT, they've been incredibly, incredibly respectful of our community wishes. Travis Cole, Alan Plunkett, they have not said no to anything. They've said we like to partner with local communities. I mean, and that goes all the way up to the state director of the local programs, Kathy Eaton McCulp. So I don't see needing to use any leverage at this point in time, but you know, nothing works better than, you know, when you have a solid group of people, whether that be city councilors or a mayor or the community at large, coming to an organization and saying, this is what we want to see as a community. And as of right now, NDOT is being very, very amicable, and I think it's going to be a great partnership, and I think it's going to be something that helps downtown revitalization, helps dress up that western corridor, helps spur more economic growth, helps complement something like Project Home Run in the future, and really helps that central residential section of our city, too, that's directly off of our downtown to the east.
At the same time, though, based on your experiences watching what happened with State Road 39, are you at all worried that NDOT is going to either skimp on some of the amenities or not do the kind of job that you're hoping that they will do if you don't show extra attention to the project, hold their feet to the fire, et cetera?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, with State Road 39, I can't speak to the specifics. I was in college and high school at the time when that road was being built. So I can't speak to what level of advocacy, if any, was there from local community leadership at that time. I can't speak to that. All I can say is now is we're not going to let that road be rebuilt without the community's vision being implemented, and NDOT's been very good at working with us, and you bet we're going to hold their feet to the fire, because I honestly think, Stan, this one roadway project, this could really define things, especially in the downtown historic district and that western corridor, and I want to see it much better than what it is today.
Of course, NDOT came in not too long ago and did a quick little resurface of the road, which made it a little bit better, but nonetheless, it forestalled the real improvement, the real digging up of the base and redoing all the understructure that needs to happen. Are you at all worried that might happen again as 2019 approaches?
I don't think so. I have been told the budget that NDOT has set aside for this, it's going to be something like a $20 million project. The reason that road keeps breaking up so readily is because the base layer is still brick. I mean, it's still bricks from the early 1900s, late 1800s, and those bricks continuously shift and vibrate as large truck traffic and vehicle traffic goes over the top of that roadway. So they know what they need to do to fix it. I'm just thankful that it's finally right here around the corner. I know this project it's been in the works for the past 10 years, and we're coming to the table as a community just like we did with the paving and saying, listen, we can't be put on the back burner anymore. Frankfurt, we're growing. We have a booming industrial park. I mean, think about the industries we have. Frito-Lay, NHK. I mean, it behooves the state of Indiana to rebuild this roadway, because our industrial park employs close to 3,500 people, Fortune 50 companies. So I think from the state of Indiana's perspective, this is a very important project for economic development, for jobs, for viability, and for quality of place for this community.
Well, it appears you're going to have to make that case now to the Eric Holcomb administration, which may operate NDOT differently than the couple of previous administrations have done. What conversations are you planning with Governor-elect Holcomb or the people he brings in to talk to them about how you want this situation to play out?
Sure. And the thing I can tell you about Governor-elect Holcomb is, and I said it on this show months ago when it was being talked about, you know, does he have the time? Does he have the funds? I think what everyone underestimated with him is he's a grassroots guy. He is a local communities person. That's where he got his start, starting up a Young Republicans organization on the youth level way, way back in the day, and then working in the Daniels administration, now in the Pence administration. He's tied to local communities, and he understands that it's the local rural areas of Indiana that really fight from an agricultural standpoint, from a manufacturing standpoint, to keep our state growing. That it's not just urban, it's not just metro, it's smaller communities like Frankfort and Lebanon and Batesville and Bedford. You know, we're part of the heart and soul of this community. So I have every ounce of faith that when we take these arguments to him and we craft a presentation that helps him understand and why we think this is important, I have every ounce of faith that he is going to want to work with us, and we will most definitely do that.
We've got a little less than 10 minutes left with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes on Ask the Mayor today here on WBAA. Call in your questions to 765-496-1999. Email them to ask@wbaa.org. We talked on last month's program about your city seeking a rate increase for your electric utility, and that vote has passed by a 4-3 margin. And I was interested in the fact that a lot of votes from city councils, as people who watch those things know, there are not a lot that are that close. And one council member, for instance, seemed to say that the council hadn't gotten enough information either from the city or the utility service board about the finances of your electric utility. A person said more teamwork was needed. And I noticed then you have on this program been very, very big on teamwork within your administration. So I wondered if that criticism surprised you at all.
You know, I'm always open to criticism, Stan, because, you know, and it's like I told my department heads this morning in our meeting, we operate based on a fess it and fix it mind frame. We can always get better. We can always communicate information better. We can always pull people together better. And that's something that I work on every single week. And I'll be the first to tell you, I mess up, but I've got to understand when I do, and we've got to make it better. Now, this particular process, no one gets into this line of work to raise rates. I mean, it's not like we're Washington, D.C. congressmen. We live amongst the people every single day that we vote to impact. So, you know, when I go to Main Street Girl tonight, or when I go to Marsh or IGA, I'm walking past Fred, who's my next-door neighbor that's going to be felt by these rates. So this was a very difficult thing for our council to approach. Now, do I think we've done a pretty good job over the years of maintaining our expenses and keeping things streamlined? Yeah, it's been 20 years since we've had a rate increase. The last adjustment we had was actually a decrease. And the average additional cost to an individual residentially will be $7 to $9 additional dollars per month. So I can definitely empathize. And to be honest with you, I think it's actually a good thing, because I think you want to have a devil's advocate. I don't like yes men. I like people that are going to disagree, because at the end of the day, that's going to give us a better result. Could more of information been disseminated? I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. We've been meeting for months on this process. Dozens and dozens of documents have been passed around on that process. So when those specific comments are made, I guess I would need more specifics, but I'll internalize that, and I'll understand moving forward that if we have larger processes like this to start much, much more in advance, if that's what the council believes is necessary, to do a better job of delegating to subcommittees, having more open public meetings where we can invite people and have more of a community conversation. You know, we can learn from this process and make other processes better as we move forward, and that's what I'll intend to do.
Do you think at all that not having a unanimous council vote impacts the response you might get from the state agencies if you're seeking their approval? I mean, for instance, they frequently will submit revised rate increase guidelines back to municipalities who give them a proposal for a rate increase. If they see that there is this kind of dissent, do you think that changes your ability to get all of the increase that you're hoping for?
I guess we'll find out. You know, we'll find out. It was a 4-3 vote. comments were made. But, you know, at the end of the day, legislatively, like I said, you know, things are always split somewhat. At least they are here in Frankfurt. Sometimes it might be 5-2 or 6-1. But the way I look at that is that means a good, hearty conversation was had, and viewpoints are on both sides of the table. And, you know, the IURC, it's their job to take a tough look at these things. So we'll see what they come back with. I do have a lot of faith in what our consulting team put together. I think we've got a great group of people working on this, and I think the case has been made very strong and very clear that we need to do something to keep our electrical grid reliable and modernized, because that's important for economic development and that's important for residential quality of place. What I think this vote will do here on the local level is, Stan, is I think it's a real clear signal and a clear flag to our utility service board and our electric department specifically that we need to streamline things, that we need to reduce costs in any area that we can, and that we need to prove to our elected officials and our community that we're doing things efficiently and we're doing things professionally. And that goes all the way up to my office. And I hearken back to, we can always get better. We can always be better at providing good customer service, and we can become better at running this business, because in the electric world, it is. And so I think we learn a lot from this process. It was a necessary evil. The votes happened, and now we move to the next step.
In just our last couple of minutes, I wanted to address one more topic with you that I've been talking with Mayors Dennis and Rozworski on this program the last couple of weeks, and that is the possibility that Tippecanoe County will start a needle exchange program to try to not only crack down on drug crime, but also on the health hazards that are associated with sharing needles. And one of the things Mayor Rozworski said is interesting, and he says he's a little worried, and he shares this view with some members of his police force, that if Tippecanoe County is the only county in the area that has a needle exchange, other neighboring counties may see people who are dealing with drug addictions in their areas come to Tippecanoe County because of the services that are available. You and I have talked on this program about your attempts to fight drug crime in Frankfurt. What do you make of the idea that people from Clinton County might make their way to Tippecanoe County to seek the services if they are enacted here?
Yeah, I can definitely see there's a point to that, and I think that's where it becomes very important, this idea of regionalism. I proudly serve on the Greater Lafayette Commerce Board. I've only been doing that for about a month now, but I am involved, and I'd like to have really good relationships. Mayor Rozworski has absolutely been wonderful. So has Mayor Dennis. You know, I'll point to the hearing authority. That would not have gotten started in Frankfurt had it not been for Mayor Rozworski saying, Chris, you know, here's something I'm doing. You know, maybe look at it for Frankfurt. So they've been wonderful. I look up to them as elders, and I respect them. So that's something that I need to reach out to them on and understand more of where they're coming from. And then also perhaps get our chief of police and our deputy chief of police and have them reach out to those greater Lafayette police departments so that we can fully understand the reasoning and unintended consequences if that happens. And going back to a needle exchange program, I'll hearken back to what I said on the last program. At this point in time, I'm not aware of an epidemic of infectious disease processes that are occurring. They may be, but I've not heard any data regarding that. But this is also something that these new county commissioners are really going to have to tackle when they get into office, because obviously those programs are implemented. But this idea of regionalism, people working together, understanding if something's implemented in Tippecanoe County, how it's going to affect them, and how transient drug users could potentially cross county lines to go there, we need to understand that. And I'll say this as well. You may have read in the news in this past week, our local hospital is going to be operated by IU Health starting next year, and addiction treatment for rural communities is severely lacking. You and I have talked about that. So yep. The needle exchange program might very well be a solution to help reduce infectious processes, but if we're going to have that, we need to have resources that we can also point those addicts to so that they can have a chance of overcoming the throngs of addiction, and that's something that I want to talk to IU about.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.